This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Ministry with Community of Kalamazoo Executive Director Rob Oakleaf discusses plans for a new facility. But first, Jeffrey Wigand became toxic to tobacco companies after leaving his job as a research executive at Brown & Williamson. He cooperated with the government's investigation of the tobacco industry. Wigand's decision to go public and the controversy over his interview on CBS's 60 Minutes was the subject of the movie The Insider. Now Wigand is based in Mount Pleasant and runs the nonprofit organization which he founded, Smoke Free Kids. Jeffrey Wigand will speak at Western Michigan University on Tuesday. His address is titled Inside the Tobacco Industry. Jeffrey Wigand, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Gordon, and good morning.
A question I like to ask someone whose story has been told in a movie is, if that is the only thing that someone knows about you, is there something you'd want to clarify or correct or perhaps fill in some details that you think don't come across well in that on-screen presentation?
Boy, I've never been asked that question. Let me see. I had very little, if anything, to do with the movie The Insider. In fact, I was blocked from cooperating at all with Michael Mann and Eric Roth, who was both wrote the script, and then, of course, Michael Mann produced it and directed it.
Blocked because of your separation agreement from the company?
No, it was because I had a temporary restraining order from a Kentucky court. And so the only really intervention I had was through my lawyers in Washington, D.C., when I became aware that they were making a movie. I wasn't really aware of it until my lawyer said, well, there's a movie going on about it. We need to talk. And then they set up a meeting to meet with Michael Mann in Washington, D.C., and I got to understand a little bit about what the movie was about. And I really had three very specific, I guess, criteria in terms of what was said in the movie and how it was said. And one was that there'd be virtually no gratuitous smoking in the movie or tobacco use, number one. Number two, my daughter's names would be altered such that they weren't using their real name. And third was that the nature of my one daughter's illness, which in the movie is portrayed as asthma, would not be treated as what it is. And that was the only three caveats that I had in terms of the movie and interaction in the movie. The rest of it came vis-a-vis the Marie Brenner article and the man who knew too much, and through the her participation in the movie, as well as Lowell Bergman's participation in the movie. The movie has helped me immensely in terms of my work and international recognition of what went on with me in the tobacco industry and also the media at the time. I mean, the capitulation of CBS 60 Minutes was just, I mean, it was like throwing gasoline on the fire. And then the release of the secret confidential deposition that I did in Mississippi when it was released to the Wall Street Journal. The ability of the media, which is something that is really contentious these days, of media really working with and helping people of conscience. That I use that word rather than whistleblower or snitch or tattletale, because I don't think one who puts public interest ahead of their own personal safety or job needs to be dealt with in a pejorative term. So I don't like the term whistleblower. I like the term person of conscience, because I think that's really what people who come forward with knowledge that is in the interest of public safety and health, and that's what I did.
Well, for other entities out there that may be talking with someone, a person of conscience, to use your term there, you know, how can we encourage more people to perhaps tell us the secrets that we should know about things that are affecting public health and safety? The media, of course, is probably a good place to start. What can the media do to make it somewhat easier for someone who has a pretty big secret under their wing to get it out there and make sure that the public knows?
Well, first of all, I mean, I talk to almost on a weekly basis to a number of people who are deliberating on coming forward with information to public interest. I mean, I really have to admonish them in terms of, you have to understand that once the toothpaste is out of this tube, your life is significantly changed. And you need to carefully think of what you're doing. Make sure that what you're saying is the absolute truth, because if it's not, it will not sustain the life cycle of what you bring forward, and you will be significantly harmed in the process of not dealing with something that factually and honestly. There is a lot to be said about people who are coming forward. I mean, I know many of them. I've worked with many of them. Some of them have come forward and some of them haven't. There is an absolute need for belief that what you're doing is the right thing. You have to understand that it's really taking your life and turning it upside down, both for you and your family and your acquaintances and your friends and whatever, and you need to be able to deal with it. I was very fortunate. I mean, I had 153 students that I was teaching at the time at a high school of excellence, a national excellence in Louisville, Kentucky, who were just my support every day. They were my psychological crutch, so to speak. So were the teachers and the principal of the school. I mean, even in the death threats that came to the school for me, they still stuck by me. So I owe them a debt of gratitude that I'm not so sure I'm ever going to be able to repay. I mean, there were lawyers that stood behind me. There were private lawyers. There were lawyers from the Department of Justice that stayed behind me, the judge that protected me. I mean, all these things that happened, the media was definitely behind me because I helped them in a process when documents were released. I became the navigator and translator of documents that were coming out from the tobacco industry that really showed the archaeology of at least 5 decades of deliberate conscious fraud. And without them, I mean, I'm not quite sure if you would be having this conversation with me, Gordon, because I would have probably wound up in the trash can. I mean, the smear campaign that the Wall Street Journal debugged, the need for armed bodyguards on a daily basis that changed the way we lived, the way we went to the store, the way my girls went to Girl Scouts, the way I drove, checking the mail, following me to school, I mean, you have to understand that once you do it, depending on the level of the 800-pound gorilla that you incite, that you got to be ready for it. I am immensely thankful of where I am today to the efforts of many other people that helped me. And I tried to share with people that it's not all the glory of a movie.
Despite all of that upheaval in your personal life, in your family life, there's a series of frequently asked questions on your website related to the movie The Insider. And the last one is, would you do it all again? And your response is, in a New York minute. Why?
Yep. Why? First of all, it was the right thing to do. It was in the interest of public health and safety. The knowledge that I had, if I kept it secret as they wanted me to keep it secret, I would be nothing but a bystander and just as guilty as those that were committing the fraud and selling a product when users intended kills not only the user, but the innocent bystander for profit. And so, again, a New York minute, the shortest minute. And I believe it has made a difference in my life. It has saved lives. It has changed the dynamic on a worldwide basis of what goes on in terms of regulating this industry that for decades has really sold a product that kills people.
When you come to Western Michigan University, students who may attend your lecture probably were either not born yet or perhaps were very young children at the time that you brought this information to the public. And I guess I'm wondering if they might think that this is stuff that they've heard before. How much do you think things changed from that moment in the mid-90s when we started to learn about what the tobacco companies knew and when they do it to now?
Well, you're most certainly right. I'm sure most of the students at 98 and were probably just being in grade school. So, I mean, I'm going to talk about Putnam's bystander. That is somebody who watches a harm and does nothing. To talk about it in terms of the ethics of doing the right thing. And sometimes the right thing is not always easy. And hope they walk away, at least with the understanding that they have an obligation when, as they go forward, whether it's in medicine, dentistry, business, or farming, that if they see a wrong, that they right that wrong by taking the appropriate steps.
I know you don't work for them anymore, but do you have any sense as to whether there has been a change at all in corporate culture with the tobacco companies, or are they still doing their best to make sure that damaging information, information that we should know from a public health standpoint, is not getting out?
Yeah, being a leopard has not changed its spots. Let's make that abundantly clear. I mean, they're back to doing the same thing they did before. If you just have to look at the new innovations of nicotine delivery devices, such as the e-cigarette, gateway products of dip and chew and sticks and flavor strips, they continue to produce products that either initiate or are suitable for initiation in terms of nicotine addiction to actually graduating over time to a product that they sell, which is a tobacco product, which is immensely profitable. So they have continued to do what they've done in the past. They obstruct smoke-free ordinances. They obstruct the WHO's framework convention for tobacco control in countries. They continue to influence using their lobbying efforts to really stop any kind of regulation. So they continue to do what they've done in the past. I mean, they have lots of money in spite of the reduction in the United States of tobacco. There's plenty of developing countries that they go to now and market their product. The industry has not changed totally, but it's changed in some places like Australia and New Zealand and the work I did in Canada and in Holland. And I mean, I just go on. I mean, I've worked with a lot of international ministers of health from Malta to Germany to Ireland to Iceland. And those environments have changed, which is immensely satisfied that I've helped change, but I'm only a catalyst in those things. But, you know, I don't have the resources of the industry, and a lot of what I do really relies on the ability of others to use their moral courage and sometimes their assets. Now, back to inside the industry, nobody will come out again. I expected, and I guess I believe that after 4 years, I mean, I wasn't a know-it-all. I knew a lot. I mean, I had access to things that other people didn't, but people that are there 20, 25 years knew that there was an internal mantra: we're in a nicotine delivery business, it's addictive and it kills people. But outside, they denied it. There was a schizophrenia. I expected that when I came forward, that others would come with more knowledge than I had, where all the rabbit holes are, where the things were swept under the rug, or where the secrets were that I did not know. But they all came out ultimately in the document. So if you get discharged from it or leave a tobacco company today, the secrecy tie-up just binds you forever. So they change their agreements and how they deal with people and what they have access to. There are also now silos of knowledge, and those silos don't really communicate with each other. So inside the industry, I don't think much has changed in terms of personnel management. And externally, they continue to do what they do best. They market a product that's addictive, that sells and continues to sell.
Silos of knowledge because they don't want someone else to be, to quote the article in Vanity Fair, the man who knew too much.
I think that's true. I mean, I did know too much. And that knowledge has benefited many people, from our own government to the government, around the world, Gordon. I mean, that knowledge has gone to help people. It's helped the Department of Justice in suing the tobacco industry for fraud and being labeled a racketeer in the federal lawsuit that was heard in Judge Kessler's courtroom in Washington, D.C. That's still going on. That is going to change it. The laws that were promulgated by the U.S. Congress on giving the FDA the authority over tobacco, while up to date they've been somewhat ineffective, but that power sits there. They need to go ahead and start using that power, as other countries have done. They have not changed the labeling because the industry fought it on First Amendment. They need to go back and assert that this saves lives. But it's going to happen. I mean, this is an industry that's 200 years old plus, and my expectation is it would change immediately. But I've learned that maybe it's going to take a generation to change. But it's changing. Go to Australia. Go to Ireland. Well, I went back to Ireland, and to go into a bar that sells Guinness by the pint, and nobody's smoking in it. A year before the ordinance, people were smoking and drinking their pint of Guinness. You couldn't get a reservation in a restaurant because it was packed with people who wanted to have a good meal without dealing with the effects of secondhand smoke. I've been the instrument or the catalyst with that knowledge that actually is changing the dynamics of it. It's slow, but effective.
And is that the work you're really doing right now with Smoke Free Kids?
I'm doing a number of things with Smoke Free Kids. One is, I really work with children around the world. Last year, I spent 3 weeks in Japan, and I dealt with doctors that are established, students that are going to become doctors or nurses, and children in fourth, fifth, sixth grade that are the target. So I work with children. I work with people that can affect the policies that affect children, such as smoke-free environments, no smoking in your car, with children tied down in the back seat, lots of things that involve not only using litigation. I'm an expert witness in many litigations that actually continue to keep that fire going of how the industry behaves, and has actually been an asset to change many things. I talk to people of potential whistleblowers. I talk to people in media that don't know how to interpret a document. I mean, around the world, and much of it comes from not only the 60 Minutes and the CBS public image, but also what the movie did. It raised it to a totally new level. The movie gets, every time the movie is shown anywhere, like it's being shown in Montreal, and I have to say my email today is just packed with questions and thank yous. So I continue to get it, and people, I have to say, continue to pass on the accolades for something that I believe was the best thing in my life to do. It was more reward than any job I've ever had.
Jeffrey Wagan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon. Have a good day.
Jeffrey Wagan is a former tobacco company research executive, teacher, and the founder of the nonprofit organization Smoke Free Kids. He will speak on Tuesday at Western Michigan University. Links with more details about Jeffrey Wigand's address can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Ministry with Community has been providing daytime shelter and other services for people facing poverty and homelessness in Kalamazoo since the late 1970s. But officials say that their current facility on Church Street is not big enough to meet demand. So Ministry with Community will break ground this summer on a new facility on Edward Street, just a few blocks away from their current building. Rob Oakleaf is the executive director of Ministry with Community. Rob Oakleaf, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Gordon.
So why does Ministry with Community need a new building?
We've been served by our facility at 440 North Church since mid-1980s, and it's served us well. But in the last 10 years, we've seen an increase in the number of people who are coming to us for services, greater diversity in the population that we're serving, more people who have homes and who have jobs who are trying to make ends meet. We've had certain environmental factors, such as the recession and the enforcement of the cap on cash benefits, reductions in food benefits. We're just seeing so many more people, and we've gotten to the point where we just don't have the physical capacity to provide our services in the most effective and safest environment.
Do you plan to continue offering the same services? Does a new building offer you the opportunity to do anything more?
This effort really is about creating a space that supports our current programs. We're not looking at expanding programming. What it does allow us to do is have the space to welcome in partner agencies and volunteer groups to have even more robust opportunities throughout the course of every day.
What are some things that you might do with a partner agency, perhaps some sort of collaborative effort?
Sure. We work with a number of partners right now to bring services to the people, since we're the place where people are. We've got 200 or 300 people coming through there every day. And for example, Housing Resources and Community Mental Health come down to help with housing issues. Goodwill Industries comes down to work with people who are seeking employment. We have a loaves and fishes pantry. So in the new space, we'll have more opportunities for those housing forums, for those education for employment opportunities. And we'll have a larger loaves and fishes pantry. As far as our own programs go, just making sure that we have the sufficient space and a space that's respectful towards its occupants and helps to bolster that sense of self-respect and human dignity that we want everyone to develop and grow so that they can move on towards self-sufficiency.
You mentioned a greater diversity of clients, and what you were getting at there is that not everybody you see coming in is homeless.
Correct.
And you're also seeing people coming to you who are employed. Is that right?
Absolutely.
What are the things that you are doing for them? How much variation is there between what you might do for somebody who is struggling and has a job as opposed to the person who really has nowhere to stay at night, much less any chance of employment at the moment.
The people that we see coming in, for example, who may have housing or may be employed, are using a lot of those services to help reduce their household budget. So we're the only provider of free laundry services. We wash upwards of 1,200 loads of laundry every month. And in fact, people sign up to a month in advance just to be able to do a load of laundry. And it's one of those ways of just cutting the budget, coming in for meals. And then also, as people are experiencing crisis, so maybe you have a home and it's the first time you haven't been able to pay your utility bill. An example of how Ministry of the Community works, we don't have funding to help people out with their utility bills. But you come in, you sit down with a social worker, and that social worker is going to be incredibly well-versed on how to access the resources to meet that need or settle that crisis. And so, for example, we would start with the Department of Human Services, which it can be a challenge to navigate through the application process. And sometimes people are not successful in that. And then the next opportunity is the Salvation Army, and after that, Catholic Charities. So while we don't provide the specific financial resource for that particular case of not being able to pay a utility bill, we are going to help navigate you through those, act as liaison and advocate for you as you try to successfully marshal those resources.
You're trying to, in many cases, I guess, then find the services that somebody can take advantage of, not necessarily providing them,
yes,
but knowing the channels that people have to go through. And helping people who obviously have a lot of other things on their minds eventually get there.
Yeah, and you know, trying to pull all those resources together is practically a full-time job. Well, when I needed to find a copy of my birth certificate, I went to one of our social workers and said, how do we do this? So that's another interesting challenge. We're the primary provider of birth certificate and ID assistance. And we pay for the process. And sometimes, as in my case, since I was born in Kalamazoo, it was as simple as walking over to the county building and asking for a copy of it. But for the gentleman who was born in Texas, whose birth was never recorded, going through the process of soliciting affidavits from family and friends around the country attesting to the date of his birth that we could furnish to the government of Texas to try and get a document that we could use to get a Michigan State ID. And this was a guy who was waiting on a job. So getting that ID was the difference between him staying unemployed and actually being employed.
Ministry with Community is a daytime shelter.
Correct.
You mentioned earlier that the periods of very cold weather we had during the winter present a challenge. More people want to come in and get warm. Mm-hmm. But you don't have a place, per se, for them to stay at night.
We do not do overnight shelter.
Do you try to help people find places?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, our first priority, of course, is making sure that somebody has a safe place to be. And the research is compelling that you really don't want people in shelter systems, overnight shelter systems, for very long. The longer that goes on, the more detrimental it is to the person's ability to get back on their feet. But we do work with our partners at the Kalamazoo Gospel Mission, at Open Doors has an emergency shelter, Housing Resources, of course, and their Eleanor Street shelter, trying to make sure that people do have, in the short term, a safe place to go. And then working very closely with organizations, once again, like Open Doors and Housing Resources and Community Mental Health, to find long-term stable housing.
You mentioned in there that you don't want people in overnight shelter for long. What are some things that Ministry with Community is doing to try to get people to, as you say, self-sufficiency?
When there are programs, especially with housing, when there were the HARP vouchers, you know, kind of that were run through the county housing authority, we were one of the many sponsors of those, and working with our partner agencies. We also try to support people as they're re-engaging in the workforce. So we have a computer lab that's dedicated to developing resumes and applying online for different jobs. We do have funds to help people if they need specific clothing or work boots when they get a new job. We distribute a lot of bus tokens to get people to interviews and to get back and forth from work for the first 2 weeks before they get that paycheck. So we work in a lot of ways to try and make sure that someone has stability. And we're not prescriptive. So we don't say, okay, Gordon, these are the 17 things that you need to do, and then you're fixed, then you're cured. As you alluded to earlier, everyone's path is different. Everyone's idea of success is different. And as we're looking at shifting our operating model, we're looking at putting much more emphasis on goal setting and helping people work through, you know, where do you want to be? It's very easy to say, okay, I want to have, you know, a two-bedroom house and a full-time job and a pickup
truck. Nice car, right?
Super. Now, how do you get there? What are the intermediate steps? What is the very first thing that we're going to do? Are we going to pursue all three fronts at one time? And then setting those short-term goals to reach the long-term goals. We do that in a more informal way right now, but we're going to formalize it as we evolve our operating model.
As you see growing demand out there, is it getting tougher to make that leap to self-sufficiency when you have that many more people? And when you find people who, yes, have jobs and do have a place to stay for now, and yet are feeling insecure enough in their economic position, are coming to you to do laundry. Mm-hmm. I mean, is just the sheer volume such that you start to say, boy, it is tough to get people from where they're coming to see us on a regular basis to they have a job, they have a place to stay, they can afford some form of transportation to get there.
It is a huge challenge because so many of the jobs that are available and accessible to someone who maybe doesn't have much education or not much work history or has spent a period of time incarcerated, those are going to be entry-level hourly positions, most often not full-time, you know, very often without employee-provided health benefits. And it is incredibly difficult to make ends meet. And to be completely truthful, we make a huge effort to hire from the population that we serve. So we've got somebody, they're using services, they're getting things organized, they start volunteering, they really show that they're working hard, and then we want to hire them. And we pay above minimum wage, but if you're working for us 20 hours a week, you're not making a living wage. And that's something that we want to work on. But of course, we make very hard budget decisions. You know, every year we depend on the magnificent generosity of our community. But it's that balance. We want to put as much money toward the people that we're serving as possible. And we also want to make sure that we're paying people, you know, who are working in hourly part-time positions enough money to live on. So it's a challenge that we face. You know, we have many of our employees use our services, including me. I went and talked to a social worker about getting my birth certificate. And as I said, we pay above minimum wage. For people who, especially longtime Kalamazoo residents who worked in the manufacturing or industrial sectors, so you've got Checker Motors and GM and the paper mills, where you could work without necessarily a lot of education and not even necessarily being fully literate. Now, the jobs in manufacturing are high-skilled and require more education, and otherwise you're looking at the service industry at relatively low wages and not full-time hours. So we're still looking for more of those opportunities, and we want to connect people with those opportunities. But it's a huge challenge for our community.
How much money are you going to need to build this new facility?
$6 million.
What have you raised so far?
4.2. And we were excited to announce last week that we have received the Van Domlin Challenge, which is a matching grant, a challenge grant, that's going to match all the donations going forward up to $1 million. So we're pretty far on our way. That's the last stretch is the hardest stretch. And so a lot of my time is out talking to people these days and encouraging them to help support. But a lot of this process is also about making sure that people know who we are and what we do, and knowing that we'll be able to do it in a facility that is designed for us and that is going to be durable and will be able to last us for decades and decades.
When is construction set to begin?
We are planning to break ground in July or August, and that would get us into the new building in early to mid 2016. And I feel the urgency every day. It's almost as though our current facility knows that we want to leave it and is exacting some sort of revenge.
Rob Oakleaf, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Rob Oakleaf is the Executive Director of Ministry with Community of Kalamazoo. Links with more information and longer versions of interviews on West Southwest can be found at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.